Hi, I'm Eric. I'm at La Pasadita, and you're listening to Outside the Loop Radio, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you, Eric. La Pasadita. Love you so much. Delicious tacos. Good morning. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. Happy to be here with you today. Thanks for joining us. This is show number 741. And what we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Say hi online. You could drop us an email through OutsideTheLoopRadio.com or WGNRadio.com. The Twitter handle at Outside the Loop, Instagram, Facebook, whatever. It's all good, and we'd love to hear from you. We say good morning to Colin Seaman, who is the producer of the show. Hi, Colin.
Hi, Mike, and I just want to underline, maybe triple underline, italicize, triple exclamation point. We love hearing from you listeners, so do that whenever. We're always game for it.
Always game for it. Always game for it. And Bob Ferguson is our engineer back at the station, so we are broadcasting from home today. I'm from my newish basement studio, and Colin's at his house, and this is something that we're going to do going forward. So today, we want to remind everyone, we're on from 6 to 7, but going forward, starting next week, the show moves up an hour. We start at 5 a.m. 5 to 6 in the morning is the new time slot for Outside the Loop on WGN Radio. Going forward, that starts next week. So Lou Manfredini expands his show, How Smarts Radio, which is great. We love Lou. And so if you tune in looking for Outside the Loop next time during, or next week, I should say, during this time slot, it's going to be Lou. So you get up a little earlier and, of course, get the podcast of the show.
I don't know. I don't know if you consider yourself handy. We're somewhat handy, but Lou's the guy you want to go to there. We're just about the other stuff going on in Chicago.
Right. We're everything else that maybe you don't talk about a ton.
I don't know, Mike. I've never opened for a major act before. I'll say that. You know, I wanted to be a musician when I was a kid. And I never had that great, I don't know, gig that we were opening for some like big name band. But I feel like opening for Lou, you know, our new time slot, sort of the arrangement that we have, I feel like we're on a world tour, if you will, and we're the opening act for like the boss or something. You know what I mean?
Lou is the boss. I like it. He is, but you know what? Here's the thing about Lou. He's very cool. Like, he's not some pretentious rock star. The way he is on the radio in public is the way he is off the mic. And, you know, so it's not like we can't make eye contact with him, which I guess we can't because we're not in the same building going forward because we're doing this from home. But you know what I'm saying?
Right. He was born to run. We're born to run. It works. It's a nice partnership.
Strap your hands across my engines, as the boss would say, right?
I don't know any more Springsteen references, so okay. I'm tapped out. I'm done.
Fair enough. Fair enough. It is a Springsteen reference, though. We'll just move on. Look, La Pasadita, you heard Eric there, the intro. Colin, you know this, and if you listen to this show, the listener, you know this too. I love that place. I used to live right over there in the East Ukrainian village, and La Pasadita was my go-to taco place, and it still is when I roll through the neighborhood at 1130 North Ashland, right at Ashland and Division. Colin, 2020, man, it's coming to get us. La Pasadita is putting the building where it is currently on the market.
So there will be no more Pasadita, is what you're saying?
We don't know. According to the news reports that I am getting here, the family, the Espinoza family, who do a great, great job, because revenues were down 50%, they were working with a skeleton crew, as the owner, David Espinoza Jr., says that we're in survival mode. They're going to sell the building. They don't know what's going to happen to the building. So maybe, I mean, look, if it's the East Ukrainian village, I'm guessing it's going to be some sort of condo building, some sort of high rise, but if you want to get that building, maybe you could keep La Pasadita on the first floor. That's not out of the question, but I don't know.
Well, I'm sorry. This is not great news around the holiday for you, Mike. How are you feeling with this news?
I'm feeling pretty banged up. Of course, nothing in comparison to, I'm sure, what the owner's family is feeling. This is obviously a very difficult time, but boy, I mean, there used to be three La Pasaditas on that corner. And I guess the story goes that, you know, years ago, like in the 70s, when the owner's father, the current owner's father, bought the place, he opened up another spot across the street because he had to pay, like, you know, protection fees to the mob. That area was kind of rough. It's definitely changed. It's definitely gentrified. But he opened up another place across the street just in case anything were to happen. That's a great story. I love that story. So,
well, hopefully this is just a restructuring, a whatever you want to call it, just like weathering of the storm. And in 2021, we're going to see La Pasadita back somewhere.
I sure hope so. By the way, if we want to buy it, Colin, we could buy it and save the business. The building is going for $10 million.
You know, I don't have that.
Yeah, I don't either. I mean, especially after Christmas. Which, by the way, did we even say happy holidays, Merry Christmas to everybody? Happy holidays and Merry Christmas. I hope it was a good one. And I hope that this Christmas season finds all the local businesses who are struggling. You know, hopefully we get a little bit of some sort of reprieve from all this. And, you know, if it's your taco stand, if it's your bar, if it's your favorite local haunt, see if you can help them out, especially during this holiday season. And, Colin, we have a lot to do on the program today, as usual, and this is sort of a housing-themed show. We'll talk about issues of housing coming up on the program today. So stay tuned. La Pasadita, love you. Let's all go get a taco and raise your cup of coffee in salute.
Now I got what I want, no matter how to use, but that's how we do it. Yeah, that's just how we do. Now put on your shirt, because victims will get hurt if they don't catch a clue.
And the local music on this week's show comes from the artist Philip Otto. You could check out philipotto.com, and he has some new music out that he released this year. The album is called Malachi, and Philip Otto, interestingly enough, from New Jersey originally, right now he is a student at the University of Chicago. So, you know, that's close enough. We can claim him as our own. Each week I love to feature local music on this very show. So if you have any, you can go to OutsideTheLoopRadio.com or WGNRadio.com. Send us what you have, and we'll try to get those songs on the radio and on the podcast for you. This week, hearing some tunes from Philip Otto. Neighborhoods make up Chicago, and one of the really fascinating aspects of these neighborhoods, I think, is what's happening out in back of many of these buildings. You may have noticed a considerable amount of coach houses or granny flats or backyard houses or any other name you might have for these small independent structures. Last week, the Chicago City Council adopted an ordinance re-legalizing these buildings, also called accessory dwelling units or ADUs. This ordinance allows backyard houses or interior ADUs at properties in one of five pilot areas in the city. Stephen Vance is an urban planner and founder and CEO of an organization called Chicago Cityscape. They work to make neighborhood property and construction development data accessible to us all. They are online at chicagocityscape.com. Stephen, welcome back to Outside the Loop. Nice to talk to you again.
Hi, Mike.
So, you know, I've always thought of these buildings, these coach houses, I've called them, as very Chicago. Can you give us a brief history of these buildings and why they are significant?
Yeah, so coach houses are a type of small house that's typically in the backyard, and they're all across Chicago. So I made a map of them. They're basically in every single community area and ward across Chicago, although they are concentrated in some areas. And they've been around for a century, and it was historically a place that you stored your horse and your carriage, if you had one of those. And then you built an apartment above it, potentially for people that worked for you, or you rented it out to somebody else, like a boarding house. But nowadays they're used as apartments, and they could be two apartments in one sometimes. And some of them are one story tall. Some of them are two stories tall. Some of them are even condos nowadays.
Yeah. And like we've been talking about, they're all over Chicago. And I know that, people have lived in these coach houses for a long time. So what happened in Chicago? Did it become at some point illegal to have these structures?
Yeah. So in 1957, a new zoning code was adopted in Chicago that outlawed the backyard houses. And it was discussed in the 2002 zoning code reform of whether or not they should be brought back. And it was decided to not bring them back. And so then, you know, fast forward to 2018, former Mayor Rahm Emanuel and the housing department added coach houses as something that they should attempt to re-legalize. And then it took a while to write up the legislation. Also, there was a transition in the mayor, and so it takes some time to restart certain policies. And then last week, like you said, City Council voted to approve an ordinance that allows coach houses and other types of small apartments once again.
So what was the controversy? I mean, in the first place, I mean, I guess from where I see it, these are kind of cool. I don't know what harm these are doing. What was the argument against having these coach houses in Chicago?
The argument generally goes like this. In the mid-1950s, Chicago was experiencing its peak population of about 3.5 million people. Remember, we're at about 2.7 million today. And the fear was overcrowding, that these types of houses in the backyard were being built without any controls or without any regulations. And thus, too many people were living in Chicago. And this was a way to stop the overcrowding of Chicago by restricting the future development of them.
And like I said, you know, I've noticed a lot of these buildings. So these buildings have been around and people have been in them. So was it just illegal to build new coach houses?
Yeah. So the zoning code today and for a long time restricted the new construction of coach houses and even restricted the continued use of them if they were vacant for a year or more. So let's say that you're the homeowner of a two flat and you've got a coach house in the back and you want to do some renovation work and you get a permit to do your renovation work. So you have to, the person who lives there has to leave. You do the work, but let's say that your contractor is not working on time and it takes more than a year to finish the work. Technically, you are not allowed to rent out that unit again.
Wow, I did not know that. So this ordinance that was recently passed by the Chicago City Council now changes some things. Can you tell us exactly what this ordinance says?
Well, it says a lot of things. I've tried to summarize it. There's a lot of technicalities to it. So basically, if you own a residential building in one of the five pilot areas and your residential building is zoned with the letter R for residential, RS2, RS3, RT4, and so on, then you can have either a backyard house or an interior ADU. However, if you have five units or more in this building, you cannot have a backyard house, but you are allowed to have two or more interior ADUs. And if you go for two or more interior ADUs, then you have to build half of them, or not build, you have to rent half of them as affordable according to the rules set out in the ordinance.
And what does an interior ADU or accessory dwelling unit look like? What is that?
So it's probably mostly going to be a basement unit because those are the easiest to build out. And in some cases, people might build an attic unit if they have enough space up there. And in rarer cases, some people may extend or add an addition to their house. And then another really common interior ADU that we're expecting is courtyard buildings. Let's say like Rogers Park. Rogers Park has a lot of courtyard buildings. They have a lot of unused ground floor space that historically was storage for the tenants or laundry rooms. that are no longer needed for either of those things, because over time the apartments have been renovated and upgraded. And so they've got the property owner has this space down there, and they would be allowed to cut it up into a couple different apartments.
And so this, I mean, I the way I see it, it makes it maybe a little bit more profitable. If you own a rental unit, you can maybe get some more mileage out of what's on that property.
That's definitely going to be an outcome, that the person who owns the building will be able to rent more units. But it also means that there's going to be more units available in high demand and high opportunity neighborhoods of Chicago, especially near transit.
And so as we look at this, how this might impact the future of housing in Chicago, and you started to talk about it right there in terms of the areas that are really in high demand. I mean, you know, you're putting more opportunity out there for folks to rent these places. But is this going to change significantly the future of housing going forward in Chicago?
I think it will change. I don't know how much. The idea of accessory dwelling units is that they are a kind of gentle density increase in neighborhoods, and gentle meaning that you don't really see it that much, and it happens slowly. So these are houses, or these are apartments that are inside existing buildings or in the rear, so you don't see them from the street. And then they only add a couple of units to a block or a neighborhood at a time per year. So I don't think it'll be that visibly significant, but it will provide a lot of new housing options for people who need to move or need to find a new house or have children or have an adult child who comes back to live with the parents, and the family needs more space.
Yeah. What about vacant lots? There are a lot of vacant lots in certain areas of Chicago. Does this ordinance address anything pertaining to that?
It definitely addresses it. I don't think it encourages it, but it's allowed. It would be allowed for someone to have a vacant lot and build a backyard house on it. Although it's kind of funny to call it a backyard house if there is no front yard or front house, but it's doable. And it would be a great way to redevelop a vacant lot without having to spend so much money, because you could use an innovative prefabricated design that could potentially cost less or be built in less time. You can do something more experimental. And also, since it's capped at 700 square feet, you're going to have lower construction costs.
Well, all of this information and more is up at your website, chicagocityscape.com. You have a nice FAQ page all about coach houses or granny flats or backyard houses, whatever you want to call them. But a lot of really great information at chicagocityscape.com. This is something that I think is really cool, because it's a part of the fabric of the physicality of Chicago when you go through a lot of these neighborhoods and you see these coach houses. Stephen Vance is an urban planner and founder and CEO of Chicago Cityscape. Stephen, as always, thank you for talking to us, and thank you for sharing your expertise with us today.
You're welcome, Mike.
Keep the sand outside. Take off your shoes, don't track it in. A new apartment on the south side said that when you're with us.
As the COVID-19 pandemic continues to impact our society, we might overlook the effect the virus has on our state prisons. Since August, the total number of infections across the Illinois Department of Corrections has risen by more than 9,000 cases, and nearly 10,000 inmates have tested positive for the virus. Jennifer Sobel is the executive director of the Illinois Prison Project. That is an organization working for a more sensible and humane prison system. They're online at IllinoisPrisonProject.org, and Jennifer Sobel is with us here on Outside the Loop today. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks so much for having me.
You're quite welcome. So give us a little bit of perspective here. When we talk about the impact of COVID on the prison system in Illinois, just how bad is it? I gave us some numbers there, but from where you sit, how bad is this?
It's a real tragedy and travesty. There are facilities where more than half of the incarcerated people have tested positive for the virus. The spread is completely uncontrolled within the department. And in facilities where elderly and disabled people are incarcerated, they have documented infection rates as high as 25%. But I think it's important to remember that the department is not testing people unless they're extremely symptomatic. And so the real numbers are probably much, much higher.
Why are they not testing people?
It's a great question. I wish I had a really great answer, but I do not. I think they would point to resources, but we know that tests are now really widely available. And you know, I don't have a great answer to that question. All I can tell you is that they are not testing people with anywhere near the frequency that they would need to in order to not just control the spread within the institutions, but just appropriately treat people for this really dangerous disease.
Well, you said that this is a failure by the state of Illinois. So what could the state have done to prevent the surge that is happening now of COVID-19 in the state prisons? Is there something earlier that they could have done?
Yeah, there were a couple of things that they could have done really early on that they did not do. The first thing they could have done was followed the lead of places like New Jersey and release people who were close to their outdates or who posed no threat to society in order to keep everyone else who remained in the system safe. So right now, there are upwards of around 10,000 people, like a third of the people in the Illinois prison system, have outdates before the end of 2021. So these are folks who are going to go home within the next calendar year, no matter what. Each one of those people could have been released early and, you know, been under the supervision of the Department of Corrections, thereby lowering the overall population within the prison system and creating space for those who remained to practice some social distancing, to practice some self-isolation. Because right now our prison system is overcrowded, which means that even if they wanted to keep people separated, to keep people safe from the virus, there's simply no space to do so.
Yeah, it's really, when you think about how prisons are run, I mean, it's just prime for viruses to spread. And I know that other diseases have spread throughout prisons, but this one is particularly dangerous, this COVID-19 virus. And the fact that prisons, as you say, are overcrowded, you can't really social distance in a prison. And you have people, in terms of employees and guards, coming in and out. So you can't isolate, and it's just a recipe for, as you say, this tragedy of spread.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
You know, you talked about early release, and the state has already granted early release of approximately 3,000 inmates since March. It sounds like you are recommending that the Illinois Department of Corrections do this on a bigger scale.
I am, and I want to push back on that 3,000 figure, which was cited a lot some months ago. If you do an analysis of those 3,000 people, and we and some other allied organizations have done just that, almost without exception, these were folks who were within 30 days of their outdate. So these were not folks who were released early in any meaningful sense of the word. They were all going to be released within the following month.
So it's interesting that 3,000 number maybe is a little misleading in the sense that they were about to get out anyway.
Exactly. Exactly. People don't, I think, really understand the turnover rate within the department. It's very, very high. Thousands of people come into and exit the system every month. And so when we talk about releasing 3,000 folks early, those people were all about to get released no matter what.
You know, it's interesting when you talk about we might not understand that number or how this stuff works. I think you're right. I think, you know, what goes on inside of a prison or just how the system operates is largely unknown to most of us on the outside here. And I'm wondering, you know, could there be more transparency? I think there should be more transparency, but it's almost like we should know how this stuff works. But a lot of times when we talk about prisons, it's sort of out of sight, out of mind.
You're completely right. And that's absolutely by design, right? We have a system that puts people, physically separates people from their communities, often housing people in institutions that are not only really far flung, but are geographically really, really far away. If you think about facilities like Menard and Lawrence, which are primarily housing people, folks from Chicago, these prisons are 6-7 hours away. communication with people in prison is extraordinarily difficult. They make it very, very hard to communicate with folks by phone, by video, by mail. Everything takes forever. And during the pandemic, it's been even worse. Communication has been even harder. And by keeping people out of sight, the system is designed to try to keep people out of mind. And I really, I think you're absolutely correct and urge people not to sort of ignore folks in prison, even though the system makes that very, very easy to do.
And I think there's obviously the stigma there, right? Of, oh, well, you screwed up. You're a criminal. You're in prison. So why should we care about you? If COVID is in the prison system, well, too bad. Maybe it's punishment. I think there's that stigma that maybe allows us to, you know, create this sort of permission structure to say, well, you know what? It's okay. I don't have to care about the folks who are inside prison because they're criminals and they're serving their time.
Yeah, I guess I would want to remind people that the crime rate in this country has, in this state too, the crime rate in Illinois has dropped exponentially over the last several decades. At the same time, our prison population has ballooned. Prosecutions from the 70s to today are up hundreds and hundreds of percentage points. And so it's not that more people are doing more bad things. It's in fact just the opposite. It's that our criminal legal machine has blown completely out of proportion and now has a life of its own, where we're incarcerating folks for conduct that in other societies and even in America 30, 40, 50 years ago were considered public health events. And so it's not that people in prison are bad people. That is certainly not the case. And anyone who knows anyone who's incarcerated will be able to tell you that pretty, pretty easily. It's that we as a society have become addicted to the criminal justice machine and using it as a way to respond to every single social ill, whether it makes sense or not.
And this is a humanity issue, right? I mean, this is, hey, people are suffering and we don't want to see that. I mean, at the end of the day, let's have a little empathy and understand that there's some folks going through some rough times all over the place, but also in prisons. And I think part of this is caring about other people. And maybe if we can learn something from the pandemic, take something away, it's to have more empathy for others.
Absolutely. I think that's absolutely right. And I'd remind people that every single person in prison has a family behind him or her, has loved ones behind him or her. Even if you don't know somebody who's incarcerated yourself, you probably know somebody who has a loved one who's incarcerated. And so this pandemic of incarceration is affecting everyone, our whole community, our whole state. And when you add in the COVID-19 pandemic, it's a tragedy of sort of unspeakable proportions.
The website is IllinoisPrisonProject.org for the Illinois Prison Project. Jennifer Sobel is the executive director of that organization that really does some important work advocating for a more sensible and humane prison system. And she was talking to us this morning about the issue of COVID-19 ravaging the Illinois Department of Corrections. Jennifer, thank you for talking to us today and for all of your hard work. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
That's what you said. I'd rather not think about it, but I can't get you out of my head.
The Institute for Housing Studies at DePaul University aims to provide reliable, impartial, and timely data and research to inform housing policy decisions and discussions about the state of housing in the Chicago region. This organization has some end-of-the-year updates. Jeff Smith is the executive director of the Institute for Housing Studies at DePaul University. The website is housingstudies.org. Jeff is here with us on Outside the Loop. Jeff, welcome back. Nice to talk to you.
Good to be back. Thanks.
So let's start off our conversation here talking about this tool that was created not that long ago, but it's called the Mapping Displacement Pressure in Chicago Project. And this is on your website. Can you briefly just remind us of what this tool is and what it does?
For sure. So this is a mapping tool that we developed a few years back. We updated annually. And the goal really was to create a leading indicator to help you know, stakeholders being folks who are trying to make decisions on affordable housing policy, really get ahead of potential displacement pressure or lost affordability pressure that might be associated with large catalytic investments in a neighborhood. So the kind of example that started this all is the 606 in Logan Square. It was a big public investment project that created a lot of positive things for the neighborhood. But one of the challenges that it also created was that on the western half of the trail, a lot of new investment flowed attracted by this, new amenity, and that created, affordability pressures for a lot of lower income, long-term residents in the neighborhood. So we developed this tool to kind of identify neighborhoods that had a lot of those, lower income renter households, vulnerable households, if you saw, rises in house prices. So we identified neighborhoods with those characteristics. And then also another layer of the map is to look at those house prices and look at how house prices were changing. So the areas where you had vulnerable populations, rising prices, we highlighted those neighborhoods on the map and then looked at, those that were high cost, moderate cost, low cost, because, in each market context, there might be a different set of potential strategies, a different type of pressure that might be present, so that when community-based groups, the city, others are trying to debate and discuss how do we preserve affordability in these areas, they have a little bit of a market lens to look at and a mapping tool to look at. So that's what this project is. We just released an update of the data. So, so it's a bit of a weird update in the sense that, as I'm sure 2020 was a bit of an oddity in a lot of different ways.
Right.
The economy and the housing market, no different. When you work with data, the data is never, a lot of data is old, right? So a lot of the data you look at is from before, March. So really, we've spent a lot of the year not just updating these data tools that we work with, but also trying to really think about, how has COVID and the COVID economic downturn really affected, housing affordability and housing market pressures in the city.
Yeah. And when we look at that question, here we are still in this pandemic and it's raging on. And maybe there's a glimmer of hope with the vaccine now on the horizon. But still, this is very much with us and is going to be with us for some time. So as we look at how COVID has impacted the housing market in Chicago and Chicagoland, what can we tell from the information that we're seeing?
I mean, it's really a very complex picture, because if you might think about it and you might see headlines about the economy being really challenging. And at the same time, you might see a headline saying that house prices in Chicago have risen faster in the last quarter than they have in the last 10 years or something. So it's sort of, it might seem like that's, how could those two things be happening at the same time? And it is a bit unusual, but I mean, I think when you look at the way that the COVID-19 economic downturn has really played out, it's really impacted, lower income renter households most significantly. So when you look at, who is not able to work, who has lost their job or who has seen reduced hours, it's folks who work in industries that are hourly wages, that are often, kind of vulnerable to shutdowns or to, just changing work environments because of the impact that COVID's had on those industries like tourism, travel, restaurants. So really, those folks are really, have had a very difficult time. And that's why this recent, the recent federal stimulus plan that was passed was essential. I mean, you can debate whether or not it was enough or whatnot, but something needed to happen because low-income households, especially those that have been out of work for a long time, needed some type of support, relief. Renters and especially and landlords as well, who have been trying to deal with the inability to pay rent, have also been struggling. So, you need some type of federal program, because the feds are the ones who have all the resources in this case, or most of the resources in this case, really needed to do something to support low-income households that have been impacted and the housing market that is affected by that economic downturn.
Yeah, going forward here, I mean, can we predict, or are there some signs that are maybe out there about how this is going to impact housing going forward, especially affordable housing? I mean, if you're not making a lot of money and you're barely making rent every month, and then this pandemic hits and maybe you can't work, I mean, that is a substantial blow to your well-being. And yeah, maybe the government can step in and help out, but I mean, this impact is going to be felt for a while. Do we know what that's going to look like when it comes to housing around here?
I mean, I think when you look, you know, sometimes people look back at previous recessions, previous crises, and this is a very different one in lots of ways, but I still think there are some things you can look back on and learn from. And one thing that we learned from the last recession is that when the economy is not going well, it more often than not affects, disproportionately affects lower income people first and worst. In this recession, that is much more significantly the case. And what that means is you're going to see a big increase in the demand for affordable housing and affordable rental housing, because you're going to have more people struggling. The economy is not going to boom back necessarily. So so there's going to be an increased demand for housing affordability in the near future. And it was already a big challenge leading into the pandemic. So I think the big concern is that all the stuff that you saw happening in the city around, you know, the need for affordable rental housing, the disparities in some neighborhoods, the displacement pressures that were present in a lot of areas are just going to be exacerbated because the people who are doing okay, were doing okay going into the pandemic, probably are still doing okay. But the folks that were struggling are now struggling worse. And we anticipate that they're going to continue to struggle worse for the near future. So I think all of the challenges that were present, you know, in February are going to even be more significant going forward in 2021.
Housingstudies.org is the website that we can check out for lots of really important information when it comes to the future of housing here in Chicagoland. That is the website of the Institute for Housing Studies at DePaul University. And Jeff Smith is the executive director of that institute. Jeff, thank you, as always, for talking to us today. And thanks for all of your hard work and wrapping your brain around this big issue. And we'll talk soon.
Yep. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Yes, the rap party for Outside the Loop show number 741, where Colin and I recap the show, offer some takeaways, and I think some important issues as we have covered in the past, Colin, this time regarding housing. I bring it back to the coach houses for a second. I am so interested in coach houses. I think they're so cool. And I'm of the mind where, and I think I've said this before, but if you walk in the alleys of Chicago and you just check out what's going on, you know, behind the buildings and in the backyards and the porches in the back, I think it's just a really cool sort of network, a sort of patchwork, if you will, of a community. And the coach houses, I always thought, were a really neat part of that. So, and by the way, I didn't know that it was illegal to be rocking the coach houses because so many people are. So that just opened my eyes, you know, in a different way to, hey, this is coming back, and I'm excited to see what the future holds with that.
Yeah, I have two thoughts. First, just on coach houses, something really interesting that Steven said was, will potential sort of ADUs in the future be made for this notion of like students or kids coming back to their parents' houses? That I thought that was very interesting because we're sort of learning now in this year with regards to COVID and housing, a lot of, you know, kids just out of college have moved back in with their parents because of the financial shelter that it gives them. Right. But just that being a sort of cultural thing that's not really in our history, you know, in American history, should I say, like when you're 18, you get out of the house. But I'm wondering, like, units like that are available, if there is sort of like a longer, I don't know, period in which kids live with their parents. That really, you know, sent my mind off in a tizzy. Mm-hmm. But I just want to emphasize this. I mean, regardless of whether it's your home, a second home in behind yours, whatever your living situation is, also our prisons, like shelter is important. Shelter is necessary for any kind of growth or for anyone to thrive in our society, right? It is food and shelter. And housing is just such an important thing to have access to and an understanding of and opportunity to get anywhere in this world. It just is. Like, yeah. If you don't have a steady home, if you don't have a steady roof over your house, you are not going to succeed in our society.
Yeah. And, you know, we've also talked about homelessness on this program many times and how that is, it's, you know, just a really important conversation to have as well. But you're right. If you don't have a place to go to call home, I mean, success is going to be very difficult. So, you know, this again, this issue of the pandemic brings that to the forefront. And I will say that I was really excited to have these conversations about housing and what's going on right now in 2020. So I just want to say, Colin, in retrospect here, happy holidays. Merry Christmas. And I hope you had a great Christmas. Did you have a good Christmas?
Yes, it was very pleasant. I love my extended family. I love my friends. I am sad not to be interacting with them as, you know, extensively as I would like, as personally as I would like. But I love my family and it was a good day with them.
Good. Good. Yeah, we had a good one, too. Very, you know, sort of scaled down, pared down, if you will. But it was fun and a lot of good togetherness. And I hope that you listening to this program had a very just delightful Christmas. And I hope you have a great New Year's. And, you know, I'm doing the morning show on New Year's Day. And we're on at an earlier time next Saturday. It's everything's going to be great. Colin, here's to 2021, huh?
Yeah, I will say, though, I am going to miss the 6 o'clock audience. I hope they get up with us. But if they don't, understood. It was a fun run, 6 o'clock. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, 6 o'clock. If you were a real person, I would give you a hug. I'm giving you a virtual hug right now through the radio. Colin, I'm giving you a virtual hug right now. Do you feel that?
Yes, Mike. The warmth. Oh, the warmth.
The warmth. Happy holidays. This has been the Wrap Party for Outside the Loop, show number 741.
Wrap Party.
And that just about does it. Outside the Loop, show number 741 is all wrapped up just for you. Thank you so much for listening to the show this week. Thanks to Colin for producing. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for being our engineer back at the station. I hope you have a great holiday season, and I'll talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop on 720 WGN. We'll be right back.